welcome to Hellbent, a feminist podcast for those who resist and persist. I'm Devin.
And I'm Melissa.
And this is Melissa McEwen, who is with us as our guest host today. Sarah is still not feeling well, so we're all hoping that she's back soon. We interviewed Melissa about a month ago, and we had a really terrifying discussion about Mike Pence. So that was great. I'm kidding. I haven't slept since. So Melissa, what have you been up to in the month since we've spoken?
Being terrified about Mike Pence.
That's
continually.
Fair. Yeah.
Yep. And also being terrified about Donald Trump continually.
Right. That's really kind of like all of our aesthetics these days.
Right. That occupies a lot of my time.
Yeah. And it's so funny because when people find out I have a political podcast, so many people, the first thing they say is, well, you know, Pence would be better. And I literally write down episode 50 featuring Melissa McEwen on a piece of paper and I say, go listen to this and never sleep again. So there you go.
Yeah, well, that's a good space to occupy. I love that.
Yeah. So let's get in what we're going to talk about today. So block one, as always, we're going to do listener feedback and some general updates. We only have one news block today. It's block two, and it's about climate change, y'all. Like, that shit is real, and there's a lot going on, and we have a lot to talk about there. Block three, we'll get into our gratitude check, which is sorely needed. Then block four, we'll get into Dickwad of the Week, because it's Monday and got to start the week out right. And then block five, we'll have some action items, so something you can do after you listen to the show.
Okay, Devin, let's get into some listener feedback.
Yes. So first off, I want to start by saying on Thursday's pod, we actually pronounced one of our listeners' names incorrectly during Thursday's gratitude check. His name is Nephi, not Nephi. So I'm so sorry about that, Nephi. And I now know how to say it, and that's amazing. So
Michelle tweeted, California is on it. They filed a separate lawsuit regarding the 15 attorney generals suing Trump to keep the DACA program, but somehow California wasn't one of them.
Yeah, I was really upset about that. And then everyone was like, okay, relax. They're filing their own lawsuit. I was like,
yeah,
okay, fine.
Yeah. Yes, that was a relief. That was a big relief.
Right? Like, I'll allow it. That's fine. So another listener, Varsha, tweeted, I just want Hillary Clinton, Resisterhood, which is Julie, Sarah, Devin, and Lauren Duca to talk about feminist politics for a few hours. And to which I say that would be my dream day, to just hang out with a bunch of smart women and talk about feminist politics. And then if Hillary Clinton wanted to join, like, I won't say no to that. That's fine. I mean,
yeah, that's a hard yes.
That's a hard yes. Hillary Clinton is obviously our dream guest, and we're ready whenever she is if she'd like to talk. So, you know.
So call in.
Yeah, right? Like call me.
Tweet in.
Yeah.
Zipporah tweeted, oh my God, my feminist Twitter universes are colliding and I am rapidly developing a terminal case of cannot.
Yeah, our Lauren Duca interview was so much fun and we got a lot of positive feedback on it. And with Julie hosting, who's Resisterhood, it was just a whole lot of feminist voices packed into an hour-long show, and it was such a great time. So I'm glad that everybody enjoyed it, because I certainly did.
That was a great show.
Yeah, it was really fun. And then finally, Katie emailed us. She said, I just finished listening to Thursday's interview with Lauren Duca. Great get, by the way. And I loved her gratitude check of readers sending their good vibes to women journalists. And it occurred to me that I needed to do that with y'all. I've never had any specific reason to email, so I've never been in touch. But Lauren's right. We need to send the positivity, especially to women on the internet. So I just want to say that you're awesome and keep up the great work. The Hellbent podcast is a solace in an ongoing dumpster fire that is 2017. I am not always surrounded by vocal feminists in real life, so the virtual community of Hellions and the Facebook group are also essential. A few weeks ago, I posted a question about speaking up at work about sexist behavior and got not only helpful specific advice about what to do, but I felt like I had a group of badasses backing me up. It literally gave me the courage to speak up and had a really constructive conversation with my supervisor about the situation. Your great work on the podcast and creating and monitoring the Facebook group is having real-life positive impact, so thank you again. And honestly, like, getting that kind of feedback is what keeps me going sometimes. Like, because everything is such a dumpster fire, but knowing that we even make a small difference to people is just makes it all worth it.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah. So a couple of quick updates, just Hellbent Headquarters general news. Reminder, we have a crossover episode with Pantsuit Politics on Thursday, September 21st. Beth and Sarah will be joining us. We also have a very exciting guest lined up for Thursday the 14th, and we'll announce who it is on Patreon early so y'all can suggest some questions for us to ask her. So if you contribute $5 a month or more, you'll get access to all of our exclusive announcements. And speaking of, we didn't do this on the first episode of the month, so we're going to do it now. A shout out to our generous $10 and up patrons from August. We have Incredimella, Rachel Panabacker, Betty Tanner, Brooke E. Couquet, Brooke White, Jessica Griffith, Monique Vanderlaan, Patty Capelluti, and Courtney Weber. So thank you so much. You really keep the lights on here at Hellbent. And if you want to be a supporter, you can find us at patreon.com/hellbentpodcast. And then finally, please rate and review us on iTunes. Seeing your feedback there warms our cold feminist hearts. So, you know, make our day.
Go feedback.
Okay, Melissa, so let's get into our news block, and we are going to talk about climate change because we have to. So can you kind of tell us what's going on in the world and why we need to talk about climate change?
Yes, and I think that I'm going to title the section, The End of Times is Here. Its name is Donald fucking Trump.
Yes, yes.
Which was actually your title. To give credit where credit is due. So yes, okay, that's the last laugh we're going to have now.
Yeah, seriously.
As we talk about Hurricane Irma, which made landfall in Florida on Sunday morning. And here's a quote from the Washington Post, which I think, you know, it's a pretty good place to start. Irma had shifted between a Category 3 and 4 designation on Sunday as it continued traveling north. Regardless of its ultimate track, all of Florida, which is about 360 miles wide across the panhandle, but less than half as wide across much of the middle of the state, most likely will experience damaging winds, rains, flooding, and possibly tornadoes. The National Weather Service has issued a tornado watch for all of southern Florida and the Florida Keys.
Yeah, it's really scary.
That's terrifying.
It is terrifying. And as of Sunday, when I looked all this up, it was downgraded to a Category 2 with wind speeds of about 110 miles per hour, which I guess is better than, you know, it was in the 200. So that's something.
Right. Right, so now it's only 110 miles
right?
per hour.
Oh my God.
With tornado warning.
Yeah, right. I mean, like, this is great, guys. Just kidding. This is awful.
Right. This is like, you know, your spiders are coming with mosquitoes.
Right.
And it's already claimed 25 lives in the Caribbean, 10 in Cuba, and at least 4 lives, maybe 5, I think the last thing I saw, in South Florida. And it's completely flooded Miami, where there's also widespread lack of electricity at the moment.
Yeah. Yeah. And the Key Largo bar is completely gone. CNN's Bill Weir was there, and he said it is, quote, unlike anything I've seen in 25 years, which when seasoned journalists who cover storms for a living are saying that, you know, shit is real.
Right. Yeah. Right. I was reading in The Guardian about what's going on with the Florida Keys, and NBC News had like the first footage of what's going on in the Keys. Mm-hmm. And at this point, they're effectively cut off from outside the world at the moment, as police are keeping people off the only road to the mainland until they can ensure the bridges are safe.
Wow.
And they're even saying, like, don't go with your boats because debris and possibly if the bridges are not structurally sound, if they fall, you know,
right.
It could be too dangerous. And during that report, like an NBC reporter said, some homes are completely obliterated.
Wow. Oh.
Obliterated isn't a word we hear a lot.
No,
you know?
Really. Especially when reporting on these sort of disasters, I find that reporters, journalists aren't really prone to hyperbole in these situations.
Right. If anything, they tend to be too sort of distant.
Right. But, exactly. Yeah. So to hear the word obliterated is something. Yeah.
Obliterated, unprecedented, you know. These sort of catastrophic words, which I don't think are hyperbole in the slightest.
No. I mean, I saw the pictures of Miami, and someone said on Twitter that it looks like a real-life disaster movie. I mean, it's flooded up to, like, I mean, I couldn't tell exactly how high, but it was high. It was flooded. Mm. And so that's not even the only thing that's going on. So also the West Coast is basically all on fire in California and Washington and all up the West Coast. And Governor Jerry Brown of California declared a state of emergency in three more Northern California counties after declaring emergency in SoCal for the La Tuna fires. So from KTLA 5, which is our local station, said, quote, there are more than 20 active wildfires in the state, including the Railroad, Pier, Mission, and Peak fires. These four fires are the ones that triggered the emergency declaration. So, I mean, it's really scary. There's a lot going on. I mean, obviously the La Tuna fire, which is now about 90% contained, it triggered evacuations from Glendale and Burbank, which is actually really close to where I live. That was terrifying. And the NorCal fires are actually threatening groves of giant sequoias, and the Yosemite Park is blocked off, which is, I mean, fires are in California are kind of the norm. We have a lot of fires here, but to threaten the groves of giant sequoias is really scary.
It is really scary.
Yeah. And the La Tuna fire is one of the largest fires in LA history, which again is saying something. We have a lot of fires. So what else is going on, Melissa?
Well, Mexico was hit with an 8.2 magnitude earthquake.
Wow.
Which is a pretty devastating quake.
Yeah.
And 90 people at least have been confirmed dead after the earthquake hit off the southern coast on Thursday. And there were multiple aftershocks, including at least six that hit 5.0 on the Richter scale. Very serious aftershocks.
Yeah. I mean, 5.0 is a huge earthquake. So if those are just the aftershocks, I can't.
Which of course also caused a tsunami.
Right. Of course.
Which was confirmed and with waves as high as almost 6 feet.
Yeah. And I guess they've issued tsunami warnings as far away as New Zealand and Vanuatu, which, wow. And of course, this quake also struck just as the effects of Hurricane Katia were starting to be felt in eastern Mexico. So they've got the quake on the southern coast and then Katia coming in on the east. So, yeah.
It is depressing and it is also scary.
Yeah.
To think about all of these things converging in the same space and what the people there are going through.
Right, right. Absolutely. And then, you know, even though Harvey is no longer battering Texas, they're fighting some serious health concerns. So can you talk a little bit about that, Melissa?
Yeah, I mean, this is something that a lot of people who have been through storms talk about, right, and try to convey to those of us who have never been through a catastrophic storm. Which is while the flooding starts to recede and there might not be any new rains adding to the flooding, mm-hmm, the long-term effects of that flooding now start to kick in.
Right.
Which is not only the damage to property, right, but health problems, yeah, right? So respiratory infections, mold threats. Mm-hmm. Mold threats are really serious, even,
yes,
for people who don't have mold allergies.
Right.
But even more dangerous for people who do.
Right.
PTSD, yeah, and other manifestations of the trauma.
Right.
Shortages of medicine, blood transfusions. I believe you talked about that on a previous episode.
Yeah.
That it's still good to give blood everywhere you can.
Right.
There's a serious mosquito problem because standing water makes a perfect breeding ground for mosquitoes, particularly the ones that carry the Zika virus. And yeah, there's a lot going on.
There is a lot going on. And, you know, Texas is interesting because they tend to turn down federal aid and they have a very limited Medicaid program. So doctors and nurses in the area are slammed. So the NBC was reporting on sort of clinics outside of Houston. And they said something really interesting that I want to read because it really puts a lot of the natural disaster issues and connects them to sort of the political problem we have with it. So from NBC, quote, no one single entity has authority over health matters in Texas, which has a history of turning away federal funding and oversight and which has a limited Medicaid program. County health authorities like the ones in Harris County take care of issues like mosquitoes, clean water, inspecting restaurants, and some vaccinations, but free and charity clinics like Christ Clinic and for-profit operations like Code 3, which is another clinic, struggle in the best of times to fill the gaps. So it becomes a political problem and a funding problem and an oversight problem. And Texas, you know, Rachel Maddow has been reporting on this pretty extensively, but Texas has an oversight problem and they have, you know, they're kind of like hands off my stuff. But that means that when it comes down to these natural disasters, resources are very limited.
Right. And I think the other limiting problem, which is a philosophical one, is that no one wants to, quote unquote, politicize tragedy.
Right.
But politics play a role in how big a tragedy this is and what shape it takes.
Right.
And what you were just describing is a result of politics. And
yeah.
So the tragedy, the disaster, the relief, everything about this is politicized already.
Right.
So anyone who actually just wants to talk about that structure and those systems is not politicizing. It's already politicized. It's just a matter of whether we talk about it or not.
Right, right. Which kind of leads us into our next point, which is, so the head of the EPA, noted dickwad Scott Pruitt, literally went on CNN and said, now is not the time to talk about climate change. So we're going to fucking talk about it. Partly because Scott Pruitt is an asshole, but mostly because we all need to talk about climate change. This is a real thing and it really needs to be talked about. So Pruitt told CNN, quote, direct quote, to have any kind of focus on the cause and effect of the storm versus helping people or actually facing the effect of the storm is misplaced. Melissa, do you have feelings about that?
I do have feelings about that. I would like to reiterate that he is a noted dickwad.
Yeah.
And so I have feelings about that as well.
Right.
Not only what he's saying, but when he's saying it, as though what he's saying itself isn't a political statement.
Right. Right.
That, like, just telling us how we should be prioritizing and determining what is and what is not helping people, that is a political statement. Because I think helping people is important too.
Yeah.
You might have guessed.
Right.
I don't think the only way to help them is to donate resources or time or energy. I also feel it's important to prevent this from happening again, if possible.
Right. Yeah. And I think that prioritizing is important, like you said, but I think people can walk and chew gum at the same time. We can deal with these immediate problems and still use these awful events to shift focus back on climate change and the environment. And this sort of reminds me of conservative pundits who say that after mass shootings is not a good time to talk about gun control and gun safety, to which I say, fuck that and fuck you. Because if not now, like if we're not talking about it, when would you like to talk about it, right?
Right. Yeah. And then, of course, not talking about it means that it happens more and more frequently.
Right.
So there's never a time where something isn't happening that we can't talk about.
Right.
So hard agree on that.
Yeah.
And also, I would like to point out that we have talked a lot about the institutional gaslighting that went on during the election, that has continued post-election and is a centerpiece of this presidency. And I think it's worth noting that climate change has really served as a dry run for large-scale official gaslighting for years.
Yeah.
And it really remains the gold standard in fuck you and your lying eyes politicking.
Yeah.
Like, it's not just the science denialism. I mean, it's that, right? But also, it's telling people that all the things we're experiencing as a function of climate change aren't what we know they are.
Right. That's a really good point. That is a really great example, well, horrible example of gaslighting and how, you know, they're trying to push this sort of double think sort of reasoning on us.
And we're so sort of inured to that around climate change that I don't really hear anyone talk about it as gaslighting, but that's exactly what it is.
You're right.
You know, like these increasing storms, like, you know, everyone sort of feels like this isn't normal.
Right.
You know, people of a certain age say this isn't what the weather was like when I was a kid around where I grew up. But, you know, it's that, like I say, fuck you and your lying eyes politicking.
No, it's so true. And, you know, and like you said, this is kind of a longstanding systemic government problem. Because funding disaster prevention isn't sexy, right? Like, there's no good way to be like, we want to appropriate all this money to sit in a fund and not do anything, you know, or use that money to build boring infrastructure, right? Like, it's not politically sexy. But I just chew on this nugget for a second. Hurricane Irma is hitting the state, so Florida, just as rebuilding aid for last year's Hurricane Matthew begins arriving from Washington.
Incredible.
Yeah. So they're already dealing with a second natural disaster, and they haven't even received the money to deal with the after effects of the first one. Like, what?
Yeah. Which, to your point, underlines how necessary prevention is.
Right.
Which I think includes setting aside lockboxes.
Yeah.
Shout out to Al Gore,
yep,
who I'm sure we'll come back to.
Oh, yes. Put a pin in that.
Aside, you know, especially when we know this is a new normal.
Right.
Prevention means like funding can't take a year to arrive anymore.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. And, you know, just on top of like the shit cake, some shit icing, you know, especially in this administration where vacant positions are the norm. So FEMA is woefully understaffed and budget cuts to the EPA and disaster prevention are all but signed into law. I mean, the U.S. is severely underprepared for the hurricanes and fires we're seeing. Joe Broussolas, who's a chief economist at RSMUS, which is a consultancy, said, quote, "After years of austerity politics, it's not clear that the government is adequately staffed or prepared to address the catastrophe on the Gulf Coast and whatever happens in Florida. Priorities need to be set." So kind of circling back to this priorities issue.
Yeah, you know, you know, Scott Pruitt,
right?
Dickwad. Is more interested in talking about the priorities of what we're talking about,
right,
as opposed to the priorities of what his department should be doing.
Right.
I mean, FEMA and the Department of Urban Housing and Development are chronically understaffed and are going to see massive budget cuts.
Yeah.
How is that? What kind of priority does that look like,
right,
for the people who are affected by these storms?
Absolutely. And, you know, currently FEMA's disaster relief fund is about $2.1 billion, and that's almost gone after Irma prep and Harvey aid. And so,
right, because it's nothing to begin with. It's
right.
Virtually nothing.
It's virtually 2.1
billion sounds huge, but in the scope of our federal budget, it's nothing.
It's nothing. And also I can't remember where I read it, but they were talking about how, you know, all these maps and trajectories and all of this hurricane data isn't free. Just that piece of it, just getting the information costs money, analyzing the information, and then actually preparing. It costs a lot of money. And $2.1 billion is like throwing a fiver at the problem in terms of yeah, the federal budget. You know, so Congress is sending a $15 billion aid package to Texas, or at least they're debating it. But the aid bill that they're considering does not even include money for Irma or Florida rebuilding. So the $15 billion is just for Texas.
That's unbelievable.
Yeah.
And going back to the staffing problem that you just mentioned,
yeah,
this money doesn't get facilitated, managed, disseminated,
right, right,
by magic. It takes people to,
right,
do all this. This is a huge project.
Oh,
and it,
yeah,
needs to be correctly staffed with competent people. And I don't think many of us have the confidence that will happen.
Yeah, I think competent people is the key phrase here. And I have very little faith in anyone in this administration hiring anyone who's even remotely competent at this. I will say that the FEMA director that was confirmed, I was reading about him, and apparently he's a solid guy. He has a background in disaster prevention and relief. And so that's great, but that's one person in this huge agency that...
It's one person, and it took Trump so long,
right,
or his administration so long to get him confirmed. He's only been in the job 2 months.
Right. Right.
This is a lot to deal with.
Yeah. And you're basically in your probation period at a job.
Right.
Yeah. And so I think this kind of leads us to climate change is fucking real and not a hoax, no matter what your racist uncle says at the Thanksgiving dinner. I mean, I don't really understand how this is still something we're talking about. And I think to go back to what you were saying, Melissa, about the sort of gaslighting part of this, you know, there's really a sinister undercurrent to this type of rhetoric. James Hamblin from The Atlantic wrote, quote, "This is a false dichotomy of the sort that's commonly used to silence talk of prevention and public health that implicates powerful industries. In the wake of mass shootings, for example, the supposed choice is between mourning loss of life and talking about the instruments of violence. In this case, the choice is supposedly between rescuing people and talking about climate change. You can do both. I don't understand why people think that this is like a zero-sum game.
Yeah, I don't either.
Yeah.
It isn't.
Yeah.
It isn't. I mean, like, this administration is really quick to say that climate change is a hoax.
Yeah.
And that now isn't the time to talk about it, you know, as we've mentioned.
Right.
And then use fiscal conservatism to justify cutting programs that research how we can be better prepared and how we can prevent further damage to our environment, thus mitigating the natural disasters that have ramped up in response to our abuse of the ecosystem.
Yeah.
So they're talking about it, as it were.
Right.
You know, they're walking some kind of walk and talking some kind of talk.
Right.
And what they're doing is saying that we're the only ones who aren't really allowed to talk about it.
Right. Oh, that's such a good point. Yeah. So it's almost like, well, you're not allowed to talk about it, but we're allowed to have this whole conversation without sort of the transparency.
A conversation and a decision-making process,
right,
that concludes we need to cut programs.
Right, right. It's so true. And, you know, if you don't, for some fucked up reason, think that the scale of these disasters is affected by what we're doing as a species. I mean, we can look at it from a purely political point of view. Since taking office, NOTA dickwad Scott Pruitt has scrubbed climate change data and research from the EPA's official website. I mean, it's just straight up. He got in there and he was like, nope, we don't need this anymore. He took data away from American citizens, which I can't wrap my head around that.
I can't either. And it's not only that he's like, we don't need this anymore.
Right.
It's like, we actively don't want it available to the citizens of this country.
Yeah, he didn't just say like, oh, this data is bullshit and, you know, you shouldn't read it. They literally aren't letting us look at it.
Right. And I would like to point out, again, shout out to Al Gore.
Yeah.
Who invented the internet, as we know. This is why he invented them, was so we could all share information.
Right.
And I bet if he had had his choice, climate change information would have been his number one
like,
you know, subject that he wanted us to share.
That's true. It's true. I would like to point out that since Harvey touched down in Houston on August 23rd, there has been one question about climate change, global warming, or environmental policy that has been asked of Trump at any press briefing. And that one question, Trump didn't even bother to answer it. We need to talk about this, and we need to have people in a position to ask the administration about what the fuck they're doing about it.
Yeah. I mean, but this continues what we saw during the campaign, right?
That's true.
Which is no policy, zero policy all the time.
Right, right. It's so true. And I would also like to just throw out there from like my own personal perspective, like there is no threat of climate change. It's here. It's done. We need to stop talking about it like it's something that's coming.
Yes.
And there was a great piece by Bill McKibben in The Guardian, and it's kind of a long quote, but I really think it's important, so I'm going to read the whole thing. So he said, quote, "That one long screed of news from one continent in one week, which could be written about many other continents in many other weeks, just check out the recent flooding in South Asia, for instance, is a precise pixelated portrait of a heating world. Because we have burned so much oil and gas and coal, we have put huge clouds of CO2 and methane in the air. Because the structure of those molecules traps heat, the planet has warmed. Because the planet has warmed, we can get heavier rainfalls, stronger winds, drier forests and fields. It's not mysterious, not in any way. It's not a run of bad luck. It's not Donald Trump, though he's obviously not helping. It's not hellfire sent to punish us. It's physics." And I think that's so important. Like, it's not something that is like debatable. Like, this is actually happening.
Visibly happening.
Visibly, yeah.
Visibly happening. And, you know, now I think this is a good time.
Yes.
To talk about Al Gore.
Yes.
Who did predict the many years ago that climate change would intensify storms,
mm-hmm.
For a start. And, you know, of course, he's just released his sequel to his landmark film, An Inconvenient Truth, on the subject of climate change. Mm-hmm. And I haven't seen the sequel yet, although I've seen some clips from the movie. And one of the things that happened in the first movie was he showed a computer-generated graphic about how intensified storms could flood the site of the 9/11 memorial.
Wow.
So kind of converging on today, which is September 11th.
Yeah.
And he got a lot of blowback for that when that movie came out. There were a lot of people who, you know, called that offensive, that he would suggest that climate change could affect that site.
Right.
And then and then in this sequel, there is footage of the 9/11 memorial site being flooded.
Right.
Because of a storm that was intensified through climate change.
That is actually bananas. Like, that's wow.
It is. And I don't know if you know this, but I'm a major Gorehead.
I did not know that. I love that. Yeah,
I am. I turned 18 in 1992. Uh-huh. And because I've always been aggressively nerdy, the most exciting thing about legally becoming an adult for me was being able to vote.
I know, me too.
Yeah. I was like more excited about that than getting my driver's license. Yeah. And I lived in a place with no public transportation.
Right.
Really saying. So because of this, like, I took my election research very seriously.
Right, right.
And a major part of the reason that I supported Bill Clinton's ticket in 92 was because Al Gore ended up being his running mate.
Right.
Who was the candidate I supported in the, you know, primary.
Right, right.
And I was like a huge fan of this senator from Tennessee who was talking about the environment, like way back when this issue wasn't even called climate change yet, at least not widely. It was, or global warming. It was mostly about the ozone layer and greenhouse gases.
Right, right.
Right? Like, remember that?
Yes, yes. Everyone was like, the ozone layer. And
right. The ozone layer is getting eroded and trapped greenhouse gases.
Right.
And basically, the entire Clinton presidency for me was about getting Al Gore elected someday.
Right.
Because I felt like I was so stressed out. Like, I went from a childhood where I was worried constantly about, you know, getting bombed by Russia.
Right.
Like, I grew up in like the Reagan era in the Cold War.
Right.
And then sort of just after a brief respite, went right into the planet. We're going to, you know, we're going to kill ourselves by ruining the planet.
Right.
So for me, like Al Gore was like the closest thing to an actual planet saving superhero that we Earth are like ever going to encounter.
I get it.
That's how I felt about him.
Yeah.
So you can imagine how gutting the result of the 2000 election was for me.
Yeah.
Instead of having, you know, a climate change visionary leading the charge to stop us from destroying our one and only habitat, we got George fucking Bush.
Yeah, seriously.
Yeah. All his like oil cronies.
And his oil cronies. It's so true. It's so true.
Yeah. Yeah. And so now like we're 17 years behind where we could have been.
Right.
Trump has pulled us out of the Paris Accord. And thank goodness a lot of mayors and governors have, you know, sworn that they're going to keep to our promises anyway.
Right.
But the truth is, I honestly think if we don't blow up the planet and if humankind actually continues for any kind of significant future, I think that even though the 2016 election is looming large in our minds right now for good reason, it's really the 2000 election that's going to be remembered as the history changer.
Yeah.
As humans fight to survive climate change.
It's true.
It's really chilling to me.
Yeah.
I imagine how different our entire world might be right now if Gore had been our president.
No, it's really true. Like, having a crusader for a cause can really make the difference. And, you know, 2000 was another election where it felt like a stolen election in a lot of ways.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, it was.
Yeah. And so, you know, sort of split screening the 2000 and 2016 elections, like, there are a lot of fucked up things because, you know, it's chilling to me to think where we'd be right now if Hillary Clinton was president. It's just such a fucked up system that we have.
Right. And I mean, as I was tweeting about this earlier today, actually, and, you know, she was the first major presidential candidate who actually made climate change a centerpiece of her campaign.
It's true. It's true.
Which I think is maybe shocking because you might have thought that Obama did that, but that wasn't really the case.
Right.
It only was now really that it came to such like a crisis point.
Right.
And, you know, when she, you know, when we went through so much of the campaign without any questions about climate change during any of those fucking debates, there was no meaningful discussion about it.
It's true.
Like, she gave an address dedicated to climate change.
Yeah.
No, and the person on stage with her was Al Gore.
Yeah. No, I remember that. And I mean, and it's really frustrating because not only were there not questions about climate change, there were no questions about policy, period. Like, apparently nobody wanted to know what these people thought about major issues that affect us.
Yeah.
Like, apparently that's not a thing. So that's fine.
And as life and death as many of those issues are and continue to be, climate change is like on a scale that's almost incomprehensible.
Right, right. Because it is.
How can we not talk about that?
Right. And it is a little abstract, I think. It's hard to conceptualize the sort of destruction that climate change can bring about. And it's hard to conceptualize it as, you know, this sort of long game that we need to play. And I think especially in our political system, we're not really set up for a long game.
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree. And that's like why I think that 2000 election will haunt us.
Yeah. No,
because
I think you're
right. Think that, you know, you can never know exactly what any president could have gotten done.
Right.
You know?
Right.
But I think that 17 years that we didn't have Al Gore as our president and the history subsequent to that.
Right.
I think that's going to be seen as an incredible missed opportunity and an incredible 17 years of self-sabotage, no, frankly.
It's true, because a president, you know, they really can shape policy that we're going to discuss beyond their own presidency. You know, Obama really set the tone on talking about immigration and these sort of things. And I don't even know what George fucking Bush did, because I don't care. But but I mean, yeah, I think you're right. I think Gore could have really set priorities that you know, forced us to look at climate change in a really real way. Well, and also to kind of bring it back to current day, where the fuck is Donald Trump?
Where the fuck is Donald Trump?
Like, I'm sorry. Mike Pence visits the FEMA headquarters with Scott fucking Pruitt and Wilbur fucking Ross, of all people, coming in by helicopter from Camp David. And Pence says Trump is, quote, monitoring 24/7 from Camp David. Like, what the fuck does that mean? Like, what?
No, he's not. He's yeah. not doing oh, that. No. We all know it. Yeah. It's bullshit.
It's bullshit. It's totally bullshit. So this, I mean, it really begs the question, like, why did Pence visit FEMA and not Trump? And I think Joy Reid on Twitter summed it up really nicely. She said, why is Mike Pence giving the national update? Is Trump golfing? And yeah. I'm thinking, yeah, that's probably exactly what he's doing.
Yeah, he's golfing. Uh-huh. He's made a bunch of weird fucking statements about Irma and about Harvey before Irma.
It's true.
Including calling Irma some big monster. That's a quote.
Yeah.
Some big monster. And about talking about how it's the most tremendous storm. It's historic. Right. It's epic. Like, I constantly am tweeting every time he does this about, it's infuriating yeah. to me that he's talking about these storms like they reflect well on him.
Right? It is so weird. He's like, well, you won't believe how big these storms are. Bigger than any in history. Like, is that a good thing? Are you saying that that's what we want?
I cannot understand what he's doing. Like, what is with the exclamation point?
Right? Like, what are we doing here? Yeah. Like,
okay. And also, like, Pence is doing the visiting, right?
Right.
He says that Trump is monitoring 24/7. Reuters reported that Pence said, and I'm going to read this quote. Uh-huh. This is Mike Pence. Clearly, the briefing that we received at Camp David this morning caused the president to have great concern for the impact of the storm.
What?
Clearly.
Obviously.
Clearly. Like, what world are we living in when someone has to try to convince us that the president right. cares about the impact of a deadly storm?
Right.
It really tells you everything you need to know about Mike Pence. I'm never going to come on this show and not talk about Mike Pence.
I don't FYI. Want you to. I want you to talk about Mike Pence all day,
Thank
every
you.
Day.
Thank you. It really tells you what you need to know about him, that he has zero compunction about trying to convince us that Trump isn't the vile scoundrel that we can all see that he is.
Right. Yeah.
Like, I don't need Mike Pence telling me clearly Trump is concerned.
Right.
Like, what would convince me, maybe, unlikely, is Trump not doing horse shit, like calling the storm some big monster.
Right. Yeah.
The most tremendous storms are not showing up to celebrate his presidency.
Right. Yeah. No, it's so true. It's so true. What a fucking asshole. Well, and I also wanted to ask you kind of about this. So Pence is out there doing the national update. He's talking about this stuff. Do you think that this is him sort of like showing the country that he is presidential and that he could be the president?
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Not only the country, but specifically like the Republican leadership.
Right, right.
Like, he's sending a message to them that, like, if the shit goes down with Trump, if they're forced to actually take a stand
right.
on getting him out of office, to try to protect Pence,
right.
you know, to say, like, look, I could really step in here and be better.
Right.
And essentially what he's modeling is that tradition of Republican governance,
right.
which is saying the right words, showing up, not making a jackass out of yourself,
right.
and pretending to care while cutting the budget.
Wow. The bar is so fucking low. Like, they're tripping yeah. over it. For the love of God. I mean, and I think, do you think that Mike Pence, because, I mean, I don't know, I have hopes that Donald Trump just, if we don't get him out before then, is just like, fuck it, I'm not running in 2020. Do you think that that's something that Pence is like aspiring to?
Yes. And I think that he's having to like tread so carefully,
right.
like do such a balancing act to be running constantly for president.
Right.
But also not make Donald Trump aware that he's constantly running for president.
Right. Right. Yeah. I guess it reminds me, did you watch The West Wing?
You know, I did not.
Okay.
Everyone tells me to watch that. but it feels too much like work to me.
No, it kind of is. I'm not going to lie to you. But there's this whole thing about this fake VP and how he doesn't get along with the president because he wants to be president. It's this whole thing and he's always campaigning and blah, blah, blah. And I feel like that's kind of happening here. Like Pence is sort of trying to like weasel his way into the presidency while still telling like stroking Trump's ego.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it is a very interesting balancing act that he's running. So this
it is
scary.
And it's also because like Trump made it clear, well, he didn't make it clear, his son did, by telling John Kasich this information that Trump was looking for a vice president who would run domestic policy.
Right.
So Trump ostensibly tasked Pence with that job.
Right.
Which he's clearly doing. That's why he's always on the Hill,
right?
Like trying to whip up votes for healthcare failures and so forth.
Flaming boxes of turd.
Yeah, exactly. That's why he's like flaming box of turd master for the White House. Turd liaison, Mike Pence.
Turd liaison, Mike Pence.
Turd liaison, Mike Pence has been tasked with being turd liaison, but also can't overshadow the president
right.
who tasked him with said a job.
Right. I really hope that he gets business cards that say that.
Well, I have Photoshop, so they'll exist whether he gets them or not.
Okay, Melissa, so now that you've terrified me again about Mike Pence and also gave me the most amazing thing in his new role, turd liaison, I think it's time to get into our gratitude check. So, Melissa, what are you grateful for?
I am grateful today for a thread on Twitter. As I find every day, I'm grateful for at least one or more threads on Twitter.
It's true.
But this one is from Ben Wickler, or Wickler, I'm not sure how to pronounce his last name, so I'm sorry, Ben, who's the Washington director of Move On. And he published a great thread on Twitter last night about how Democrats are not only organized and united in the fight against Republican erosion of healthcare access, but are also laying the groundwork for future fights for healthcare access expansion.
Yeah, that's so true.
Yeah, and it's really great, and it's great to see. And I'm not sure, especially because our media is really bad about how they talk about, the Democratic Party
right.
and their strategy.
Right.
I'm not sure that this is entirely clear. So I was really grateful for this thread. And he links to a handful of bills that would broaden healthcare access in a variety of different ways. And then he makes this terrific point about the purpose that the introduction of these bills serve and what they reveal about the Democratic Party's commitment to defending and expanding healthcare access.
Yeah.
So I'm going to read part of his thread now. So this is Ben Wickler. The point of these bills isn't to pass something via McConnell, Ryan, and Trump. It's to drive the kind of debate we'll need for later. None of these bills will be a perfect finished product, and none is a litmus test. They're constructive attempts to envision the future. During the Trump years, most of our focus is necessarily on averting horrors. ACA repeal, DACA repeal, voter suppression. And yet, it's a part of maintaining our moral integrity to not merely resist, but also to prepare to build again. We can't become what the GOP became in the Obama years, enraged and hollow and feral. The point of our politics isn't revenge. We do have to win. Our side sometimes forgets that, but we don't win for the sake of winning. We don't seek power for the sake of power. The point of our politics is, as Paul Wellstone said, doing well for the people. Now, realistically, he notes, it may be a long time before there's another attempt at universal health care. But when it comes, we'll need big ideas. And in the meantime, Dems laying out a vision is a way of showing what they stand for and who they fight for.
Yeah.
That all of us are created equal and endowed with inalienable rights. That healthcare is one of those rights. What a radical idea. And that's the end of what Ben wrote.
Right.
But there's much more in his thread, which I recommend.
Yes.
And it is a radical idea that healthcare is a human right.
Right.
but it shouldn't be. And I'm really grateful that a number of members of the Democratic Party continue to push the narrative that healthcare is a right and push it in a number of ways, including stating it plainly and also introducing imperfect and often incremental legislation that will subtly but tenaciously shift that conversation in the direction we need it to go.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Sometimes introducing bills isn't to get them passed, but to force us to talk about it.
Yes,
yeah,
exactly.
I love that.
And also to have a debate about something that's been something that the Democratic Party has been debating for a while now.
Right.
You know, revolution versus incrementalism.
Right, right.
You know, and what is actually doable and how we get to the place we all want to be.
Right.
This is really a process argument. I think we're all in agreement. We need healthcare for everybody.
Right.
And we just need to talk about what the best and most doable way to get there is.
It's such a good point. It is such a good point because I do think it's a process issue. I think Democrats are generally ideologically aligned, but sometimes lose sight of working together to get those sort of tasks done.
Well, right. And I think there's always, this is just a generational thing in some way too. And I don't necessarily mean by age, but in terms of like how long someone has been involved in politics,
right.
You know, kind of generational, like I've been, you know, people who've been looking at it for 20 years versus people who are newly engaged.
Right.
You know, how things actually work and what is actually possible
right.
is something that you kind of don't always understand when you first get involved in politics.
Yeah.
And I say that no judgment or criticism at all because I was there myself.
Right.
You know, there's a lot of times when I wanted everything. I wanted to go in with the biggest idea, you know, and get it done fast. And it normally just doesn't fucking work that way, which is frustrating.
Well, yeah, it is frustrating, but it's also true. So,
Right.
Yeah.
But I think the big idea helps drive the conversation, even when it's not doable. And the incremental idea can sometimes move us further, quicker than it seems.
Right. It's true.
So I'm a fan of both.
As we say on the pod, it's always both.
Yeah.
Oh, that's such a great gratitude check. I love that.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
I would love to hear your gratitude check.
Okay, so I have two. I'm going to do the first one pretty quick. So the president of the UC system, Janet Napolitano, is suing Trump to save DACA, which is fantastic. So Napolitano was actually a key architect of the DACA plan when she was Secretary of Homeland Security in 2012. The three-page memo creating the DACA program actually has her signature. She's the one that pushed it through. So now she's the president of the UC system, which serves over 238,000 students across 10 campuses. Basically, the lawyers filing the case are, quote, accusing Trump officials of violating administrative procedures and constitutional due process requirements by abruptly ending the program known as DACA. So first of all, Napolitano is a badass motherfucker. Like, she not only created DACA, but now she's using her role as a private citizen to stand up for her beliefs. She believes in her words. She wrote them for the young people that she now serves. And she's using her role both as Secretary of Homeland Security and the president of one of the largest college systems in the U.S. to create a safer place for kids who just want to fucking be here. So she is my gratitude check, and I love her.
Yay.
Also, side note, because we're talking about the UCs and I can't not talk about Davis. Gary May is our new chancellor at Davis, and he replaced a dickwad who was there. She was horrible, and he's the fucking best. So that's also part of my... He was installed on August 1st or confirmed August 1st, and he's the fucking best. So...
Yay.
Yeah, I love it. And so my second gratitude check is kind of a weird one, but it's something I do want to talk about. Sunday, so yesterday, was World Suicide Prevention Day. And I wrote about this. I mean, I'm someone who has dealt with suicidal thoughts and actions, so this day means a lot to me. And I have a whole thread on Twitter, and I'm going to read it here because I feel like I did a pretty good job of summing my feelings on it up. So it's long, so bear with me, but I think it's important. So I have dealt with suicidal thoughts and actions for a lot of my life, including while I was pregnant. There is nothing shameful about this, but it does speak to the invisibility of mental illness. It is a lonely illness. It is hard to describe to friends and family what is going on or why their suggestions won't help me. If someone tells me working out will cure my depression one more time, I may scream. At a time where it feels like the whole world has become a giant steaming pile of shit and stress, those with depressive disorders can feel particularly alone. It's not about, quote, choosing to be happy. Fuck you, random Twitter troll making the rounds. It's not about the quality of the people around you. It's not about what you have or don't have. It's not about a job or a significant other or your parents or your kids, though they can play both positive and negative roles in depression. It's about imbalance and trauma and soul-crushing loneliness that can never really be effectively explained. Suicide is a real problem. More than 800,000 people die by suicide every year, with 25 times that number who attempt. World Suicide Day's theme this year is Take a Minute, Change a Life. While you can't cure someone's depression, you can always be a positive influence in their life. Being kind goes a long way. Reaching out goes even further. Checking in on an old friend can change a life. It's not just lip service. Feeling alone and actually being lonely are two different things. Knowing that people love you is so, so helpful. Talking to your friends and family about mental illness, depression, and suicide can make all the difference in the world. Even if someone looks happy and bright and bubbly on the outside, or 3 months pregnant, as was the case with my most recent episode, you never know what's going on inside. So regardless of whether or not you know the person's internal life or struggles, being kind and thoughtful is always a good plan. I struggle from bipolar disorder, and I recently had a manic episode and had to adjust my medication. Even mania can bring about suicidal thoughts and actions. There's a whole spectrum, and sometimes a text from a friend or a kind word from a stranger can make everything okay, even for just a minute. Sometimes it's just the minute you need to save yourself or save another. So I'm going to link to all these resources in the show notes, but if you or someone you know is suicidal, the National Suicide Prevention Hotline is 800-273-8255, and their website is suicidepreventionlifeline.org. So we'll link to all that in the show notes. But basically, I'm so, so grateful that I've had the support in my life. I've gotten the treatment that I need, and I'm stable and happy and healthy now. And, you know, for everyone who has a kind word, it's really so important. That's what I'm grateful for.
I'm grateful for that, too. Yeah. That was a really lovely gratitude. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, so we have a couple of listener gratitude checks, and most of them come from our closed Facebook group, Dickwads Beyond. So if you want to hear your gratitude here, join us at facebook.com/group/Dickwads Beyond. It's a lot of fun. So the first one is from Stephanie. She said, gratitude check for Time Magazine's first. Recognizing incredible women in politics, sports, military, entertainment, art, journalism, science, and more. I almost cry every time I think of Ilhan Omar being elected the same night that Hillary Clinton was not. Incredible women creating their own spaces and being the guiding hand to pull more women up with them. Women of all kinds have not and will never give up. So that's time.com/collection/firsts. And it is really a great article.
And this, our second listener gratitude check is from AD, who writes, last week, four or five of the parenthetical popular boys in my class came sprinting up to my desk after recess. They told me excitedly all at once that their exceedingly shy classmate, parenthetical, selective mute who didn't speak for 2 years at his last school and still mostly only whispers to me rather than talk to his peers, had scored a touchdown. They passed the football to him because he wasn't playing with anyone and then blocked for him so he could score. I had never talked to these boys about including their classmate. They just did. And this kiddo who hadn't spoken for years participated. Y'all, my heart just about burst.
That is so lovely. I love that.
Me too.
All right, Melissa, so it's Monday, and so we are doing Dickwad of the Week. We have an honorable mention and a loser. So who is our honorable mention?
Our honorable mention is Polk County, Florida Sheriff Grady Judd.
Oh, great.
Grady Judd said that law enforcement officers would be checking IDs at every shelter, and that if you have a warrant, turn yourself into the jail. It's a secure shelter. This is his response to Irma.
Right.
Is threatening people who have warrants that they will be arrested if they seek shelter.
Sure.
Now, that's a pretty big dickwad move all on its own.
Right.
But I have something else to tell you.
Oh, God.
This is possibly not even true.
Right.
What he said. As there were reports that prisoners in a federal prison just east of Houston were subjected to horrible conditions. BuzzFeed News reported, quote, for nearly 2 weeks after Hurricane Harvey made landfall in Texas, inmates at a federal prison east of Houston lived in squalid conditions, were given minimal amounts of drinking water, and were restricted from freely communicating with loved ones, the relatives of seven inmates told BuzzFeed News.
Great.
So double dickwad.
Double dickwad.
Yeah. The Twitter reactions to this guy were pretty epic.
Mm-hmm.
Did you see any of those by any chance?
I did. They were pretty funny. And actually, one of them that I saw was from a dickwad that works at Breitbart News. So, you know, take that as you will. But, you know, when even the dickwads at Breitbart News are like, this is wrong, you need to look at your life and look at your choices a little bit. yeah. So Charlie Nash, who's the dickwad who works at Breitbart News, tweeted, What if people lose their ID? Will they be unable to take refuge from the hurricane? Will children have to provide ID? Which is actually a pretty good question. And then David Roth said, it's insanely badass to endanger the citizens you serve. I hope your tweet goes viral and you get whatever benefit you were hoping for. Of all the gross things that America has invented and mass produced, aspiring celebrity tough guy sheriffs has got to be about the grossest. Yeah, and using disasters like this to scare people just is for their physical safety, but also their safety from the government, is such an insidious use of authority. Like, it's gross.
It's incredibly gross.
Yeah.
It's incredibly gross. I don't honestly understand how anyone could sleep at night.
Right?
Like, and again, going back to earlier in the episode, mm-hmm. how is this not politicizing
right.
the storm?
Right. That's a really good point. Yeah. So that is a dickwad. That's like several dickwads, like all kind of rolled in there together. Melissa, who is our loser for this week?
The loser for this week, and thank you for giving me the opportunity to also announce this dickwad. I'm not even going to give his name. I'm going to give his name as Representative Something or Other Douchebag.
Yes.
And Representative Something or Other Douchebag literally said of Representative Pramila Jayapa, quote, I'm deeply disappointed in my good lady from Washington. My good lady.
My good lady.
She doesn't know a damn thing about what she's talking about. And you may not know me, young lady.
What an asshole.
And I will let you take her response.
Okay. So she fired back. She basically very politely stood up and called him a massive dickwad and got the moderator to get him to sit the fuck down. They literally said, gentlemen will suspend. Gentlemen will take a seat, which I just love that. Like, take all the seats, Representative Douchebag. He also denied saying that he said damn. He literally said when she came out, like when she responded to him, I didn't say damn. You said damn. This whole thing was recorded on C-SPAN and he definitely said damn. I don't understand why people double down on that. Like you're literally recorded. What is the logic here?
Not only that, but they clearly don't understand how the internet works
right?
at all.
The internet is forever, my friend. Al Gore was like, I'm going to make this shit forever.
Smart man.
Smart man. yeah, so basically, Representative Jayapa is the first Indian American woman in the House, and at 51 years old, did not appreciate being called a young lady. And she went on to say in a Broadly interview, quote, some male colleagues may think that it's a compliment to say that somebody's a young lady, but it's not. There are lots of ways to compliment women of intelligence and substance, and calling them young lady is not one of them. So, you know, don't take this shit. You are better than that. Be Representative Jayapa and call out this dog whistle sexism. That shit is ridiculous.
It is ridiculous. I just don't even understand, like, who thinks that's not ridiculous.
Right? Oh, it's so weird. Such a
weird
story.
Which, by the way, is an indication, because no one does think that it's not ridiculous.
Right, right.
This is an indication it was deliberate.
Oh, absolutely.
He knew what he was doing.
Oh, absolutely. Okay, Melissa, so last but not least, let's get into some action items. So things that our listeners can do after they're done with the show. So what do we have first?
First, some donation recommendations.
Yes.
You can donate to the ongoing Harvey relief effort. Money is, as always, the easiest and most usable type of donation. But as mentioned on the last pod, blood is always needed, no matter where you are. And if you're close to the disaster area and it's safe to do so, volunteer. And even some item donations are welcome, though you should check to see what they need.
Right.
Because if you give stuff they don't need, that just creates more work as they have to sift through it.
Right.
And also more garbage.
It's true.
And garbage is quickly becoming a problem in the area.
It's true.
So if you can afford to, donating money is still best. And you can still text Harvey to 90999 to donate $10 to the Red Cross. The New York Times has also compiled a list of reputable charities and organizations that need help and how to give it to them. Similarly, you can also donate to Hurricane Irma relief. And it's still early to be collecting for relief, but do make sure you're donating to a known charity or organization. Watch out for scams.
Yes.
Google scams and they'll tell you which ones are going around.
Mm-hmm.
And again, donating physical items can be more of a burden than a help. So think twice before you send blankets, clothes, or toys into a disaster area. Transporting, storing, and sorting donated goods can divert resources away from more pressing work.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And like you said, it creates garbage, which is a problem in these sort of post-disaster areas.
Right.
So.
Right. And so, what do you have for us?
Okay, so our last two are more kind of general call to actions. We need to remember to stay on top of DACA. DreamActToolkit.org is still a great resource to call and tweet at your senators and representatives about the DREAM Act and make sure that they know you want them to support this legislation protecting dreamers. Also, call your reps. I mean, this is sort of like evergreen action item, but blow up those phone lines, get annoying, make sure everyone you know is doing the same. I mean, this matters. And, you know, when we blew up the phone lines about healthcare, it fucking failed. So let's do that again. And on that note, healthcare is still a fucking thing too, unfortunately. And I know that it's a lot. There is so much going on. And remember to take a breath and take care of yourself. But we need to push our reps and senators about healthcare. From Vox, the Senate Help Committee is in the midst of a fast-paced, good-faith effort to pass a bill that will stabilize the Obamacare marketplaces in 2018. But enter Orrin Hatch, the Utah senator who chairs the powerful Senate Finance Committee, weighed in on their efforts today to make clear he was not a fan of what he's seen. So we need to call our senators and representatives and make sure that they know that we still are thinking about healthcare and their votes matter to us and we control your job. So get on it. Okay, Melissa, that was a great show. Lots of information. I really enjoyed talking to you.
I really enjoyed talking to you, too.
Yeah, this was fantastic. I mean, so much to think about with climate change and the 2000 election and Mike motherfucking Pence, literally.
Turd liaison Mike Pence.
Turd liaison Mike Pence. Well, thank you again for joining us today. We are all hoping to see Sarah back here soon. We will keep you updated and we will see you on Thursday.
Thank you so much for having me, and get well soon, Sarah.
For more information on today's episode, please visit our website at www.hellbentpodcast.com. You'll find the articles we've discussed as well as additional resources. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at HellbentPod, and you can follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/HellbentPodcast. We also have a fan group called Dickwads Be Gone, which you can find on Facebook.
Please listen on iTunes and rate us 5 stars, because that's just like the rules of feminism. We also have a Patreon, and you can find us at patreon.com/hellbentpodcast. You can support us for as little as $1 a month, and for $5 a month, you get access to exclusive content, mini podcasts, and behind-the-scenes looks at the making of Hellbent.